Welcome to Lock and Key Unlocked, a podcast about Joe Hill and Gabriel Rodriguez's comic book Lock and Key and the upcoming Netflix series that is approaching so fast, faster than a coyote tracking you down. I'm Alex.
I'm Justin. I am locked and keyed and ready to go.
I'm Pete.
And we are going to be talking about the third volume of Lock and Key, the comic book series, Crown of Shadows. This is published by IDW, written by Joe Hill, art by Gabriel Rodriguez, colors by Jay Fotos, and letters by Robbie Robbins. Now, as we've done in the previous episodes, I'll mention this again, we are going to be doing spoilers for Crown of Shadows and the comic book series Lock and Key. This isn't necessarily spoilers for the Netflix series, because that's a little bit of a remix version of what went on the comic book, but tread lightly if you don't want to know, and definitely if you haven't read Crown of Shadows and are planning on it, read that first and then come back here, because we're gonna spoil the crap out of it.
It's source material, and I think I don't count knowing the source material as a spoiler, because it doesn't actually tell you what is necessarily going to happen in the show. It's just fun to see how they use what you love.
Yeah, it'll be interesting. I still stand behind my thing that they're going to just video record the pages of Lock and Key.
Well, that's how most book-to-screen adaptations happen, such as The Witcher was the only thing that I could think of off.
Yeah. Oh, wow. No, you're clearly a literate person, and you said The Witcher, which I believe is a video game? I think it's a video game.
It was a series of Polish books first before it was a video game. But the Netflix series is...
How about Little Women, Alex? How about Little Women?
Nah, yeah, Alex, how about Little Women?
Is that good? I haven't played that one yet. What is that for, Xbox?
All the characters are playable. It's really fun.
I'm so close to unlocking Joe.
Yeah. Oh, man. Wait, she's a wild card. You never know what's going to happen until you know.
So as usual here, I'm going to start off with a couple of notes about Crown of Shadows, but I wanted to clear the air about something first. Pete, before we get into an argument like we did the last time, have you read any interviews or watched any 2 minute and 21 second clips online of Joe Hill and Gabriel Rodriguez being interviewed by IDW talking about Crown of Shadows? Just want to check.
Goddamn right I did.
Oh, great.
I'm going to talk about it the whole time.
Well, hey, Pete, real quick, what GIF did you see that you're going to quote from for this whole podcast?
Mainly Baby Yoda GIFs.
Yes. So I will say we kind of threw ourselves under the bus last episode saying how we didn't quote our sources. So I did go back. There's a really good, really, really long, like crazy long piece about Joe Hill and Gabriel Rodriguez that's on a site called Women Write About Comics. The headline is 10 Years of Lock and Key, the Creators on the Journey So Far. And it's from a panel that they did. And this was crazy to me. Like I skimmed past this part of the intro and read the stuff with the interview. It was from a panel, and then afterwards the writer caught up with him and chatted with him a little bit. But it was from the Emirates Airline Festival of Literature in Dubai.
Which, oh, yeah.
I'm kind of pissed we weren't invited to that, to be honest.
I feel like we might have been. You know, those are the kind of things that once you get there, it's totally worth it.
So you're saying we got an invite, but it probably went directly to spam because they're like, hello, I am a prince of Dubai and you must come to my festival of literature. We will pay $1 million. Well, too bad.
It's literally the biggest mistake of our lives.
So definitely check that out because it's great. And there's a lot of really fascinating information as Joe and Gabe talk more about their comic books.
Put some goddamn respect on his name.
Never. I never will. A couple of notes about Crown of Shadows, though. It was originally released between November 11th, 2009 and July 14th, 2010. We talked a little bit about the awards. Oh, Pete is raising his finger, his little wormy finger, just poking it up there.
I just want to...
It's gross.
You know, I just wanted to say, you know, Gabriel in the 2 minute and change interview did talk about how this... And I didn't really kind of pick up on it as much the first time reading it because so much action happens in this. Mm-hmm. But, like, he talked about how heartbreaking this... specific trade was, and kind of rereading it, I found that very much to be true.
I won't be satisfied until you remake this video playing both Joe and Gabriel, and we release it in our podcast feed.
Oh, that would be awesome.
We should do it, actually. Could you dress in costumes, Pete?
Yep.
Excellent. A couple of notes that I wanted to give about this one. There weren't a bunch of background things that I necessarily found like the last two. There are awards we'll be talking about more down the road. But some one thing that we haven't really talked about other than the preview episode is the stuff that was going on in the background while they were making the comic book series, which is that the first issue of Lock and Key came out, as Pete knows, beginning of February 2008, because as he talked about, he rereads the series every single year on the same exact date. What date is that, real quick, Pete?
The 21st.
All right. You got it. God damn it.
I feel like I need to be sucked
back down to hell or something.
I love it when Pete gets a win on Alex. Another trap set.
Yes. Got him. So 4 days after that, on February 25th, 2008, right after the first issue debuted, Lock and Key was actually picked up by Dimension Films. It was optioned, and the plan at that point was to create a feature film out of the series. Now, you may or may not know this, but Dimension Films was originally part of Miramax, which was owned by Disney, which was started by two guys who split with Disney and split with Miramax. And then Dimension Films was bought in 2005 by their company, which is called the Weinstein Company. And, of course,
very
that's
notable.
Bob and Harvey Weinstein.
Come on.
I mean, I didn't invent history, Pete. It's just how it worked. So you can kind
of
say,
this up?
Well, I'm bringing it up because it's kind of lucky that it fell through. And in fact, the Weinstein Company and Dimension in particular were facing a lot of financial hardship. Though by February 2010, about midway through when Crown of Shadows was happening, the rights were kicked over to DreamWorks, who bought the rights for Alex Kurtzman and Roberto Orsi. And I don't know if that's how you pronounce his name, but I'm just going to roll with it and we'll see where we go to.
Soft C.
The two of them that you should probably know just about their point of their history, they were mostly writers by this point. They had written the 2009 Star Trek reboot, which is great. They had also written the Transformers films, including just had written Transformers Revenge of the Fallen, everybody's third or fourth favorite Transformer film, I want to say.
Yes, definitely. I could walk you through each of those very different plots of those Transformers movies right now.
We all know Bumblebee is the best one, so it doesn't matter.
Yeah, at this point, Bumblebee hadn't come out. They had produced one feature, which was Eagle Eye in 2008, another one of everybody's favorite movies. But they were looking at this point to produce more projects in addition to Fringe, which is actually a very good series that they had co-created and were working on behind the scenes. At that point, when they took over, the plan was still to make a feature film, but very soon after that, plans changed. And that's the point that we'll pick up on with the media history, where we talk about the next volume, Keys to the Kingdom. The last thing that I do want to mention, Crown of Shadows is the beginning of Act 2 of Lock and Key, along with Keys to the Kingdom. And unlike the last volume, which was a prologue, 4 issues, and an epilogue, this is essentially 5 issues and an epilogue, though I think they think of them more as one story than the previous volume. I could be wrong about that.
I mean, it feels like one story, except for the 6th issue is this sort of very dark, sort of separate bottle issue, really, focusing on the mom.
I get what you're saying with bottle issue. That's pretty sweet.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking
sweet
about.
Sweet bun, dude. Let's do some recap for what's happened so far before we get into Crown of Shadows proper. All right, Pete, cool your jets, dude.
Cool your jets, man.
This comic book focuses on the Locke family. The patriarch of the family, Rendell Locke, was murdered by a guy named Sam Lesser. While Sam Lesser was searching for a bunch of mysterious magical keys at the behest of a strange creature known as Dodge. Now, we have later found out that Dodge has a number of identities, including the woman in the well, which is where we originally find him. He also turns out to be a boy named Lucas Caravaggio, who is friends with Rendell Locke, the guy who was murdered way back in the day, probably, what do I say, 20, 30 years earlier, something like that?
I would say 30 years, like when they're kids, when they're teens, the same or similar age to the kids that are our main characters in this volume.
Ooh, because history repeats itself. So they were friends back in the day. They discovered these magical keys. Things got very messed up. something happened to Lucas that we find out a lot more about in this issue, but he got corrupted in some way. Their friendship fell out. Several of them died, and Rendell Locke moved away from his hometown of Lovecraft, Massachusetts, eventually becoming a guidance counselor at a school in San Francisco until he was murdered by Sam Lesser. So the rest of the family, which includes Nina Locke, the mother, Bodie Locke, the youngest, Kinsey Locke, the middle child, and Tyler Locke, the oldest, who is almost 18 years old and almost ready to graduate from high school, they all moved back to Key House, his ancestral home in Lovecraft, Massachusetts. Once there, they discovered the woman in the well. They discovered that she's searching for a bunch of these strange keys, and they came into conflict with her. They also came into conflict with Sam Lesser, who, driven by Dodge, escaped from prison, came back to Key House, confronted them, and ultimately they beat him. But moreover, Dodge, who escaped from the well, had taken on the identity of an 18-year-old boy named Zach Wells, snapped Sam Lesser's neck, and kicked him through something called the ghost door that had his spirit leave his body, closed the door so he was trapped outside, so his body really did, in fact, die. So Sam Lesser is a ghost floating around outside. The other thing, important piece of information that we found out last volume, is, which doesn't play in quite as much, but I still think is good to know, is that one of the kids back in the day was a woman named Ellie Whedon. Ellie Whedon has a son named Rufus. Rufus is autistic or on the autism spectrum, but Ellie Whedon was in love with Lucas Caravaggio, had a relationship with him, and in a moment of weakness brought him back in Well House, a small house right to the side of Key House, using something called the Echo Key. And ultimately, that is the being that we are dealing with, the villain that we are dealing with throughout most of the series, at least to this point. A couple of other characters you probably know about. Kinsey has taken her fear and her sadness out of her head using the head key, which allows you to go inside people's heads, take out their memories, take out their emotions, other things like that, as well as put information back into it. But when you put information into it, it's very clinical. You just get the text, not necessarily the understanding. Tyler had developed a crush on a girl named Jordan, who several other people in town have described as a psycho bitch. Tyler is also very good friends with Zach Wells, though, of course, he doesn't know that Zach Wells is actually Dodge.
His sister, Kinsey.
Right. They had started smoocheroo-ing by the end of the last volume. However, there's another character that's kind of in love with Kidsy. His name is Scott. He is a alt-punk type dude, Spider Jerusalem, as you called him in the last episode, Justin. Yes. He has a friend who I am blanking right now on the name of, but I'm sure has a name, who hangs around with him. And that's probably pretty much it for right now. What else? We got a preview of some of the other keys that pop up this volume, but I guess we'll talk to them when we get them. Anything else we should talk recap-wise before we hop into it?
What other keys are on the table? Because I think that's important. You said the echo key and the head key. There's the gender swap key, which is in play. There is the omega key is the ultimate goal of Dodge.
There's also the anywhere key that Dodge got pretty early that allows Dodge to go anywhere as long as there is a door to travel through space. The other thing that's actually very important to mention is at the end of the last volume, the kid's uncle, Duncan, experienced a great tragedy. He first was involved in a bar fight with some homophobes who were egged on by his boyfriend, Brian. He had his memories wiped at some point in the past. He was a young kid about Bodie's age back when Rendell and Lucas were friends. His memories were taken out at some point, but when he got hit with a bottle, when he got knocked out, his memories were jogged and he started to remember that this kid, Zach Wells, may not actually be who he says he was. In the process of that, though, a series of circumstances led to Brian getting hit by a car, and as we find out in this volume, knocked into a coma and knocked unconscious, which has kind of distracted Duncan from warning Tyler and the rest of the kids that something is wrong with their friend.
Yeah.
So that all said, let's let's jump into it.
Did you talk about Nina, real quick, did you talk about Nina, the mom, who has a drinking problem and is sort of a little bit of an absentee mom, but she has a budding friendship with a local detective named Mr. Mutuku?
Yes. And he seems to be very apt. He is a good detective, not just a small town detective. So that's an important
small
character
towns,
thing.
Small towns are full of good people, Alex. I know you're big city ways. Exactly.
I mean,
I grew up in the country, and every single person in my hometown was a great detective.
Well, you had all those murders. Oh, yes, Pete.
Justin, to correct you, we don't know if she has a drinking problem. Her partner was murdered, and she's turning to booze for comfort. It's not clear that she has an ongoing problem.
She is hiding bottles in her drawer. What do you think a drinking problem is, Pete?
I'm just saying you get a grace period if somebody is murdered where you can go off on a little bit of a bender, okay?
Yes, I won't dive into what you're talking about per se, but I will say everyone in her family is very unhappy with her because of the amount she's drinking. How about that?
That's true. Yeah. I'll give you that.
And then also, Pete, I just wanted to compliment you on that shirt you're wearing that says, I don't have a drinking problem. My only problem is the drinks aren't coming fast enough.
Yeah.
That's fucked up t-shirt, man.
I mean, you got that on a cruise, right? You got that on a cruise ship. Your full line of cruise wear.
Yeah. Nice shorts, by the way. I appreciate you wearing shorts to our podcast taping, Pete. Nice shirt, nice shorts, no service.
And the headband that says, is it wine o'clock? That's very
cool. Oh, man.
Oh boy, pizza lush. Let's talk broad strokes.
I'm not the one drinking on this podcast. JT says
nobody is. Nobody knows.
No. What are you drinking again? What is this called? Demon Porter or something like that?
It's a random beer that someone left. It's called Spike Devil Porter. I don't know where it's from. Oh, it's from Chatham, New York. But isn't that interesting? Spike Devil. That sort of fits with the theme of the Crown of Shadows.
Ooh, thank you for drinking your beer.
It's creepy that someone left it in your house.
Yeah, it was someone who just appeared through a door from nowhere. So that's pretty crazy.
I love someone
who brings over a drink when they come to visit.
Yeah, always do that. Let's talk broad strokes for Crown of Shadows before we get into the specifics. Since I think it is interesting as we're revisiting this, Justin, I know you said Head Games was your favorite volume.
Yes.
What was your general take on revisiting this one? Pete, what were you thinking while you were reading this?
I was just surprised at how emotional it is. I remember loving the action sequence and how much fun it turns into. And it really does kind of go back to what we were talking about before, where like they really play with your emotions, but there is so much fun in this book, and there is a lot of love and closeness, even though there's so much horror going on as well.
We talk a lot about on this podcast about how confident Joe and Gabriel were with their creation of this book. And this is where I feel like the rubber hits the road action-wise and where they start to play with the form of comic books in general. Like we get there are two issues that are just like have these great wild action sequences that are just
hell yeah,
so well made. And you can feel them sort of being like, okay, we've got this story. We're confident in our ability to just tell this story. Let's see if we can play with the form and start to really amp up or elevate the way this book goes. And I think this is when they really first started to do that.
Yeah, I think, Pete, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe they do talk about this actually in the clip, that they felt like they're doing this as a comic book. They're setting up these magic keys. If they didn't ramp up into action at some point, it would have felt wrong to them. So that's definitely what we get in this volume. But at the same time,
quote, Alex, great quote.
Thank you so much. Great interview. By the way, Justin, we should invite you sometime. Pete and I get together usually every afternoon, crack open a good Spike Devil Porter, and watch these 2-minute clips of Joe and Gabriel.
Wow.
You got to chug the whole time the clip's going. That's the hard part.
Yeah, it's a drinking game. It's a comic book video interview-based drinking game. I love the idea that you guys get together secretly.
We try to race the clips. We try to race the clips with our drinks. And
yeah, exactly.
Every time
Gabriel Rodriguez smiles, you got to chug.
Yeah.
Pete died several weeks ago, by the way.
Yeah. Again, Pete talking about how easy it is to not have a drinking problem.
So let's jump into this. We did say that
Alex has got his book open, so it's time to start.
All right.
Story time.
Wait, what did I do? What did I do?
Flip.
I don't know.
Flip.
I don't know. I don't like, let me be honest, I don't love those noises. Just from a way of like, are you, you're licking your hand, I guess, when you make that sort of a sandpaper noise?
It's, you know what it is? I think I got it right the first time, and every subsequent time it's just been a little too growly, like I've been doing it too much of the back of my throat. I'll work on it. I'll get back to you guys. The first page of this book, I love the first page of this because it immediately sets up the theme they're playing with the shadows in such a simple way. We get these five repeating panels of Tyler as he's sleeping. The first panel, there's light coming in from the door. Second panel, we get to see Lucas's shadow. And the last panel, we get to see Nina's shadow as she's drinking. And I love this. Like, it's a simple way of introducing the theme. And I am always so curious with something like this because I know, you know, Gabriel Rodriguez is drawing by hand. Does he redraw every single panel every single time? Does he tweak it through scanning? How does he hit that? Because there's definitely similarities, but it almost feels like it's fresh every single time he goes back to it, you know?
If I had to guess, I would think that he does it separately. He redraws it, but I don't know. That is so much work.
Yeah,
it's really impressive because it's not until I reread it that because the first time reading it, I thought it was just the mom's shadow because that's who he ends up talking to. But then when I reread it, I was like, oh, crap, not the case.
Yeah, and speaking of rereading it, like I love rereading this. It's so like not that I forgot a ton of it, but like the tension is so sharp and like granular that like it really picks you back up, even though you sort of know mostly where the story's going. But you get to notice so many more details on a reread like this. So it really is just I really loved rereading this.
One also nice thing about this opening scene, because we get to see Nina sobbing. She's woken up Tyler. She's telling him about what happened with Duncan and Brian, and she's drinking and drinking. This is the central conflict of this volume that ultimately pays off emotionally in the last issue, which ostensibly is an epilogue. It's not exactly part of the Crowd of Shadows storyline, but Tyler and Nina's relationship reaches a breaking point by the end because of her drinking and because of what she does. And that's such nice structure that you could set that up here right at the beginning, pay that off at the end six issues later. That's really good and really emotional.
Yeah, and the complicated relationships that they use such a light touch establishing them. And like the way that Tyler clearly cares for his mother, but is also just like, you know, he can't tolerate the way she is, so he just has to sort of very carefully sort of handle her. It's just so, it's never said, it's just shown, and it's just really smart. One other thing I want to say real quick is that this is the beginning of the second act, and I feel like it's very rare in stories, fantasy stories, or any story really, where the characters are so like behind the story as our main characters are here. They don't know much about anything. They are losing to Dodge over and over again. Mm-hmm. Dodge is running circles around them. This feels like sort of the point of no return area where it's usually reserved for like the going into the third act of a story. And instead we get it so early where the characters are just like so lost and we're stressed, I feel like, watching this unfold.
I would like to say, though, when you were talking about the family dynamic and the relationship, like it's so well done, like a real family where like each parent deals with kids differently. And like you can tell like the mom is really hurt when she sees Bodhi when she's like this, you know, and it's like she's OK because the other kids are older or whatever. But like it's just so well done. And like Justin was saying, it's not really talked about, just shown.
Yeah. The other thing that they do really well here at the beginning, and they do well throughout, that I think we've touched on before, but they vary up the pace of issues very well. Like here, we're starting, other than the first page, which is relatively dialogue-free, then we get two very heavy dialogue pages involving Tyler and Nina that cut immediately to one of my favorite pages of all time from the series. Ooh. As they exit out of Tyler's room, and he says, don't joke. Sometimes I swear the shadows of this house move around on their own. She says that, actually.
Yeah.
And we've talked before about how Gabriel Rodriguez has a background in architecture, but you can see just the, I always think about the lines that work as a panel border without actually breaking up into different panels. We're on the top of the staircase. You have Nina and Tyler walking along. They're all in color. Then you have these two lines, which again are very much like a comic book border. And below it is Zach, aka Lucas, lurking there, evilly staring up at them. And it's such a good surprise. Like, to Pete's point, if you didn't know it was Lucas on that first page, you wouldn't think it. Like, and then if you go back and look, you realize, oh shit, of course, he's been lurking here looking for these keys the entire time.
And then what's even crazier is the foreshadowing on his t-shirt, that he's wearing a ghost t-shirt. And, mm-hmm. you know, like, not only has he been a ghost, but there is a ghost fight coming.
Of course, you
and
mean
then also
ghost from Pat from the movie Ghost. Patrick Swayze.
No, it's a Pac-Man ghost, but I appreciate what you're doing.
Just be careful, though. When you say the word ghost, we all have different connotations.
That's true. That's a good point. Thank you, Justin.
Right. And this is also, sorry to Pete to interrupt. I just want to keep talking about this Pac-Man ghost shirt because it really does foreshadow, and this is a huge spoiler for how it ends, but they ultimately beat Dodge by a big yellow guy comes out. They lure him with a bunch of cherries and pellets. And he gets there, and he's about to eat them, and then a big yellow guy comes out and eats him, and he goes, yeah. doo, 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 doo,
and he has to go back to prison. I would like to say, though, last time we talked about amazing cereals, Pac-Man cereal was an amazing cereal.
Wow, okay. I wasn't allowed to have that.
As we're talking about the architecture of the page, though, also you have in the corner, you have a kid pointing to the lock house in such a kind of creepy key house. Sorry, yeah, it's.
No, you don't
the
want
more
to,
you examine this,
you don't
book,
want to go to lock
more
house.
You love it.
That thing, yeah, is hard, I believe, hard to get into.
I could be wrong. I'll take a look for it, but I believe that's actually one of the panels from the Guide to the Known Keys, right? Or it's the same art style at the very least, which is a thing that we saw in the last volume, and then we get a little bit more of the story of what happened around the Revolutionary War. It certainly looks like it's from then. So yeah, that's something that's kind of neat as well. And then we get, right after this big reveal, actually, sorry, I do want to actually seriously say something about the t-shirts, because it did jump out to me that it's such an easy thing in comic books to be like, and here's my color. Like, I am wearing green t-shirt and I am a different character because I'm wearing red t-shirt. It's much harder to have A, actual designs, B, clothes that actually seem like they fit human beings, and C, then add designs to them so that they feel like they drape in the right way. And that's something that Gabriel Rodriguez does with almost every character, and it's kind of amazing to see. Like, to put that extra level of effort into the costuming is very impressive.
Yeah, I mean, this is a very specific point, but like most comic books, the characters are drawn where the clothes sort of stick to their bodies, like spandex, even the characters in regular clothes, because I think that's how most artists are trained, are like master the form, then throw a costume on. And Gabriel Rodriguez, like, it really feels like they put that shirt or that sweater on, which I think is especially cool because it's Massachusetts, it's New England. Everyone feels like they need a little bit of coziness. You know?
I should mention that I'm wearing clothes that are sticking to my skin, so that's why I identify with most comic books, but not this one.
Yeah, no, thank you for bringing that up, and thank you for wearing clothes at all.
But speaking of, like, Alex, you were talking about the color change. What's interesting is Dodge's ghost t-shirt does change color on this next page. It goes from, and I'm colorblind, so I might be wrong, but it goes from blue to green, it looks like.
You're right, even though you are colorblind, but I think that has more to do with he's in shadow. Maybe. Ooh. Maybe. I don't know. Or maybe it's a serious fuck up and I hate this comic book now.
Well, or maybe you never know. It's just a different one of the Pac-Man ghosts.
Yeah.
What's maybe we'll get a no prize, but for like lock and key. So like a lock prize.
Yeah, no prizes went away, huh?
Sad. Yeah, they really did. I always wanted to get one as a kid. For those of you who don't know what we're talking about, there used to be a thing where you catch a mistake in Marvel Comics, but you had to explain it and explain why it wasn't actually a mistake, and then you would get a no prize. And the no prize is they would send you an empty envelope for Marvel Comics. There you go. Man.
They good stuff. Really, they really had a talk about confidence.
Yeah. So then we get another one of my favorite pages, or one of the biggest holy shit moments of the series, at least up to this point, where Dodge goes through the ghost store, turns into a ghost, and then you see something on the back, on his back, attached to his back. And as he turns around and we get to see more of it in his ghost form, ultimately we see that it has sort of these tendrils that are reaching into his heart as well as on his spine. Getting to this page and reading it again, I could still remember the feeling seeing it at the first time. And I even remember us talking about it on the show and being like, what the fuck is happening? What is this thing?
What's that stretchy eyeball alien that's hanging out in the back?
It kind of it reminds me a little bit of like Blue Beetle's deal.
Yeah. I think that came later, but.
Yeah, and again, the fact that they have the whole story worked out to such a degree that we just get this little detail here is so cool. And right before this moment, do we see Dodge holding all of the keys so far? And I feel like that's that he has. I feel like that's such a scoreboard moment, and it really is like, oh, fuck. These lock kids are not doing good.
Well, to your point, I think it is, yeah. I mean, it is a scoreboard because by the end, they've gotten one or two of the keys back, or multiple keys. I think Dodge, by the end, has one of them at the end of this volume. Is that right?
No. Yep. He has all of them that he has there.
No, but after the fight.
They get the Crown of Shadows, and they have, I think, the head key, but he has the rest of those keys that he has there.
Okay. Yeah, but still, I think they're 100% on point with that is our way of keeping track of how up or down everybody is. But the rest of the issue is taken up with not just filling in the blanks in terms of what happened with Sam, how he got together with Dodge, how Dodge first reached out to him. As an Echo, she/he was able to travel through anywhere that you could Echo and was promising great things. He even promises to give him a body back if he will just use his ghost powers and find the Omega key for him. But ultimately, Sam is pissed off now, and we get, for the rest of this issue, this amazing ghost fight. They jump back into this new Zach body and fight in it, which again, very incredible fight, but it jumps back and forth and we get a lot more information about how these ghosts work. They're essentially souls. They can be destroyed. Sam
and hurt.
Luke and hurt because Sam, by the end of the issue, has multiple scars across his soul. He's lost a hand that he's very tentatively reattached to his body. And Lucas says he's destroyed souls before. But also, it becomes very clear that Lucas needs Sam to find the Omega Key because he can't find it on his own. And the crazy thing, I think, that they do emotionally in this issue so well is that for the first time, you feel bad for Sam.
Yeah, I think that is so. The fact that this issue makes you feel sympathy for the horrifying villain of the first arc, and you truly are on his side in this fight, and you're like, are feeling sympathy for him, is an amazing turnabout for a story to pull off.
Yeah.
Because I think you do. I think it's, you honestly are like, oh, God, I wish this guy could get out of this situation where it's like, wait a second, he just tried to kill. Not only the dad, he did kill the dad, and he tried to kill all of our protagonists at once.
Yeah.
And yeah, then it's crazy. You're rooting for the lesser of two evils in that fight.
Oh, shit. Oh, that's good shit, Pete, right there.
Take a lap, Pete. Do you realize what you did? You feel like it looks like you don't realize what you just did. amazing fight. Amazing art in here. I love the different use of color as well. It's such a simple way of delineating which is which. And it would be an easy choice to be like, ghosts are blue. But having Sam be a green ghost and Dodge be a blue ghost just makes it easy beyond the creature that's on his back. And the big thing that happens at the end here is we get this full page spread of Nina discovering the Echo Key and not quite remembering. As we've established, adults don't remember any of the magic, but she's certainly heard about keys before. And she's certainly been told about them as Sam was looking for them with Rendell.
I mean, I feel like she knows about car keys for sure. And Hobbs keys.
I don't know if she knows about car keys. I'll tell you also what, adults forget car keys as they get older.
That's true. Very true.
It's also interesting to see like what the books are behind her and next to her there. You know, that you talked about how they were fighting and they were different colors. There's a book right there that says The Color of Death. You know, that's very interesting. You got Don Quixote in the back. You've got, you know.
Well, the books are the credits because they didn't come at the beginning. They come at the end. So Color of Death is by Jay Photos, who's the colorist. The Storytellers is by Jay Hill and Gabriel Rodriguez. But there are a couple of others. There's Ubik by Philip K. Dick. There's Don Quixote is up there. A couple of other things like that. There's Jack London. I assume it's Call of the Wild. Ray Bradbury, The Martian Chronicles. And man, again, like not to get on the shirt thing again, but to draw a bookcase full of books, all with different wording on the spines is bonkers.
What a nightmare.
Yeah.
Yes. So let's jump over to chapter 2 in the cave. This starts off with Jordan and Tyler hanging out at a big statue. Again, this volume does a lot to continue to build up the history and legacy of Key House. And we see this enormous statue here that we also ostensibly end the volume with of Colonel Adam Craze, who is...
He invented Craisins. Little known fact, and was famously quoted, "The dreams and ideas of free men are as an army of shadows and are as impossible to strike down. Buy these dried up cranberries."
It's funny that they don't mention the craisins there, but he is standing on something that kind of looks like maybe it is a large craisin.
That's what I'm talking about. That's my theory about this comic.
But he's the character, or the craze is one of the characters from The Guide to the Known Keys, that story that we're slowly building there. But Tyler, still trying to use the keys to work his literal magic on Jordan, says that he is going to write an essay for her so that she doesn't fail. She kisses him. He's pretty happy about it. And then we get another nice swoocheroo with Lucas kissing Kinsey on the head. Scott, I'm curious to hear what you guys think of Scott, because like Scott is such a loser, but I love him so much. And this panel at the end of the page here, where he's just popping around the tree.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right after Lucas leaves is so much fun.
I mean, I feel like Scott is textbook, like, kid that is like no one likes in high school, but will grow up and be like a very cool adult. And like, he's like the surrogate comic book writer, I feel like, in this. And I think he's great. He's a great character. He's a character that has a distinct voice right out of the gate.
And distinct look as well.
One thing I want to say about this Tyler Jordan scene, like, I love the panel of him just laying there, like, fully confident in what he's done. And I think the bookend, the other side of this scene that we get in the second to last issue, or the last issue, I forget which, the second to last issue, number 5,
yeah,
is,
I think it's
so huge. And we'll talk about it when we get there, but I think that it's a major point in the story.
Yeah, I am very curious to get your take on that panel. That's something that, frankly, I wasn't totally sure about, so I'm glad you have an idea about it. And then we get the main plot of this issue, which is Kinsey is talking to Scott. They come up with this plan because Scott has seen some names, including her father's name, down in the drowning caves which doesn't sound like a good place to go.
Don't go there. Don't go there.
Right. So Kinsey takes her friend, Scott takes his friend, and they travel down to the drowning caves. And we get this awesome hero shot of Kinsey standing on the rock. I'm sure this is totally obvious, but I feel like I almost feel like this is a visual reference to something, and I don't know what it is. You know what I mean? Like, it looks like a comic book cover from something.
I feel like it's just like the classic Spielbergian. I mean, this is basically Stranger Things. This issue is like could have been Stranger Things.
This part here reminds me of Goonies, though.
Yeah, Goonies. Perfect.
Yeah. It reminds me of E.T.
Yeah.
I don't know. I thought we were just naming Spielberg movies. We also get another big major tease here as they're going down to the drowning caves. They find out, they very casually mentioned that it was barracks. It was used as barracks back in the American Revolution, which is something that we loop back to in one of the Golden Age books, I believe. But as they walk by, and it's very clear that they leave it there, they find a door. Kinsey is like, huh, what do you think is that door? And they walk away. And as they walk away, they just say, guy, I was thinking of room stock with kegs and aged beer. You lot all daydream bigger than I do. But if you look at it, there's a one on the door, but the shape around the door is an Omega symbol. Yeah, so seems like that might be something that perhaps people are looking for a little bit.
Yeah, that's the future right there. And if you, the Omega symbol is like a fucked up horseshoe.
Oh, yeah. And there's no winners in horseshoes and nuclear bombs. Is that what it is?
Wow. I can't believe how badly you understand that quote.
Yeah.
I believe the quote is, close only matters in horseshoes and hand grenades.
Oh, right. So.
Hand grenades and horseshoes, yeah.
That's why, though, I was watching Chernobyl and they were playing horseshoes, right? At Chernobyl.
I don't know, man. Like, you need to get out of your content bubble and your big city ways and go out and have a Spike Devil Porter and play a game of horseshoes.
Man, Ricky Gervais 2.0 over here.
Yep.
Looking forward to you hosting the Golden Globes next year, Justin.
Yeah, definitely. Wow. That's the most insulting thing you could have ever said to me.
Yes. So this also breaks down as one big action sequence, essentially with a lot of emotional stuff that breaks for the characters throughout. As Kinsey goes searching, she doesn't have fear anymore, so she's not worried about anything. They got to go down some rickety stairs. The water is freezing. It turns out the caves have flooded because the tide has come in. She sees some text, which is the Keepers of the Keys. She sees her father's name, Rendell Locke, but she wants to see more of it. At which point, the stairs collapse. Everybody falls into the water. Finally, Kinsey's friend and Scott manage to hang on. But the other friend and Kinsey, using one glow stick, go around the entire cave and find no exit there. Absolutely no escape. God, if somebody got stuck down in those caves, that would just be the death of them. Something that I'm sure we'll loop back to at some point later on.
No. Don't know. You can live through this. This issue is a perfect example of how you can go to this cave and come out smelling like roses.
All right. Well, if there was a teenage character that, say, looked like Justin or something like that, mm-hmm. that got trapped in a cave like this, I don't think you would make it out, but we'll talk about that some other time.
I guess we will see. I love the way this whole sequence plays out. It's tense. We know it's very stupid that they're going in here, but it's sort of, and then they have these like great, like John Hughes movie style conversations about like who they are as people and the teenagers, and they, Jamal and Kinsey kiss, even though Scott's the one that likes her, and everyone's just so cool in this moment, except for the friend who's like sort of stressed out the whole time.
Right. The other thing that I think is fascinating that this brings up is it really deals with the ramifications of Kinsey removing her fear, in particular her sadness as well, but her fear, and what that would do to you. And while I was reading this issue, I certainly wondered, if you had your fear removed, would you realize how bad that is, and what would it take to realize how bad that is? And it almost feels like reading this issue that Kinsey should get to the point where she realizes, oh, wait, I got to put my fear back in, but she doesn't do it.
But I think the lesson here is that, yeah, she her lack of fear gets her in this situation, but it also gets her out. So it's hard for her to learn a lesson about that. It takes the rest of this whole story of Lock and Key for her to learn that lesson.
Yeah. You need your fear. That's why you say something, Pete, or are you just licking your lips?
It's also tough because it's also tough because, like, as kids, you know, at least I felt this way that, like, I was a little slower to be realizing, like, oh, I shouldn't be doing this thing, or oh, you know what I mean? So it's like I liked how natural that felt, that these kids wouldn't be so aware of themselves and their actions.
I mean, they have that conversation later on. Tyler is talking to Kinsey after, at the end of the volume, they've taken out the Bodhi's memory of what happened with the shadows, which we'll get to in a moment. Yeah, and they say Tyler says, we can't take out his fear. He's 5 years old. He would walk into traffic immediately if you let him do that. And the interesting thing that I think they're ignoring is, like, they're still kids too. You know, they also can't deal with having their fear taken out, and that's something they're not ready to face yet.
But I also get that, like, when you're that age, the difference between being, like, 17 and 15 is a chasm. Like, you're like, I'm basically an adult. You don't understand what it's like to be a senior or a junior or whatever. So it's like, I think that is perfectly played in this.
Right. And we're all 19 years old, so we look at 17 years old and we're like, simmer down, kid.
Yeah, grow up, you 17-year-olds. When you get to 19, your body still functions fine, like ours.
And then we get to something that I had completely forgotten to ask you guys about two episodes ago back in Welcome to Lovecraft. There's a quick shot of Dodge in the well looking in a mirror and seeing this rotting corpse thing, which we do, in fact, loop back to here because Kinsey drops the glue stick. We see it slowly go down through the water.
Oh, man, what a shot.
It is an amazing shot. We see another Omega type entrance, maybe down there. But more importantly, we see what certainly looks like Lucas's corpse in the dress that he was wearing in the well with that rotting face that he saw in the mirror. So at this point, if you're a reader, I think you could put together the pieces here that Lucas, as we've kind of found out, did die. What we're seeing is an echo of Lucas in some way. Some sort of entity has taken over that echo. And that's the actual Lucas who seems to have been gender swapped down there, though we don't know how or why that happened at this point.
Yeah.
Yep.
The fact that we follow this glow stick down past the list of names and have this reveal, I just think is so well paced. It's just such a great, it reminds me, like, Joe Hill has gone on to do a bunch of comic book work, and he has this line coming out from DC with a, like, sort of horror or dark fantasy style stories. And there's this one called Basket Full of Heads. And this issue reminds me of that comic where it's just like, small town, like, tense, bad things are happening to people, and the pacing of this moment is so much like that. Check out those comics if you like Lock and Key, because they're also great.
Then in the next issue, we start to get into the main conflict for this particular miniseries. We start out, of course, with shadows. Tyler is chasing after Bodhi. We see his shadowy claws coming after him, and they discover what we later find out is the giant key.
Yeah.
And this is so much fun. I love everything that happens from this point on in this miniseries. Like, I liked it anyway, but this is the point where it becomes a blast to read, a terrifying blast point, but a blast. They see this lock there, an enormous lock that you could potentially stick this enormous key in. And this is something that I think, to be honest, like, I did not realize the first time when we were reading this through, is that there are actually two parts of the magic. This is going to sound so dumb when I say it out loud, but you think about it as like, oh, they're magical keys, but they're also actually magical locks and magical implements and magical doors. And that's part of it as well.
Yes.
Almost like a lock and a key.
Oh, interesting. Mm. Oh, we should also tell them that they misspell lock a lot in this, like, on the covers and throughout the series. We should tell them about that.
Yeah, we should send them a letter or something like that.
Yeah.
I just, going back and seeing this, like, seeing the design of the keys and how, like, if you really look closely, it shows you what the key does once put into the lock, like, on the key. It's very cool. And, like, I didn't notice the first time that there's a little kind of, like, human that, it, like, shows growing into a bigger one. And I just now looking back at it, it's just so cool.
I love that they find it and they're sort of like, Tyler's like, oh no, here we go again with this shit. Like, yeah. he's not happy about it.
Well, he's not happy about it, but at the same time, he is very willing to use the keys to his own advantage, particularly when it comes to Jordan, which is the funny part there. I think he more just doesn't want to lift it. He's like, oh, this looks so big. And Tyler is such a fascinating character to me because they really do write him as a meathead. They could write him as like the heroic kid who is leading them, you know, and he's, like he does hero stuff by the end of this volume in particular, and he is starting to learn to get there, but he has a while to go. Like, he's not even refusing the call. He's just like kind of a dude bro and just wants to be a dude bro, and that's it. And all this other stuff keeps interrupting and pushing him towards adulthood and responsibility.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true. I mean, but you know he's like depressed. He is a very sensitive and like dealing with a difficult family situation and trying to like be the father figure to these other kids. But also like a lot of kids, like his identity at school is to be like a meathead. So like,
yeah,
I think that is just, I like that.
Yeah.
It feels real.
Oh, I love the character. I think it's just, it's well written because he's not, again, your typical straightforward, like, I'm the hero type guy, so much as he makes mistakes and he wants things that he should not want and he goes for them and he messes up.
It's nice. I want to get a clipping of you just saying, I'm the hero, and have that just play in every movie when the hero presents himself, him or herself.
They do that in Rise of Skywalker, actually. Yes. When Kylo Ren is, spoiler, redeemed, he comes out and he says, I'm the hero, Rey. He's also a parrot at that point. Then we get a little bit of business.
Too soon, man. It's too soon.
Too soon to spoil it. Sorry, everybody. Listen, I know we keep looping around to this, but at this point we find out that Nina is going to go visit Duncan, help him out with Brian over in Provincetown and everything that's going on. She also talks to the police detective, who again seems very nice and interested in the key that she found. But Kinsey discovers she's been hiding bottles. She clearly is drinking very hard and getting more and more wrecked, but ultimately is leaving anyway. And Kinsey confronts her and says, glad you're not taking Bodhi in the car with you. I can smell the liquor on your breath. So things are very bad for her at this point.
Yeah.
We also get the first hints of what else went bad for her, because we haven't really seen what happened to Nina while everything was going on with Rendell and while everything was going on with the kids, where they talk about a little bit, look, I understand things were bad for you, and we haven't really talked about that much, but they sort of skip over it and then come back to it later in the volume.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Then
I like how Kinsey's fearlessness or lack of fear mirrors how a teenager might act in this situation, mm-hmm. where just like a mom confrontation like this that feels very real, despite the fact that she has been magically altered to be able to have this confrontation.
Yeah.
Yeah. Also, there's a fun play on like when Kinsey's holding a bottle and you see the shadow of the mom, like they were still getting like a lot of like, artistically done shadows in these panels.
Yeah, I'd be curious to see beyond the obvious shadows when it is like literally a shadow behind somebody, if they used more ink, more blacks in this particular volume than they did in the previous volumes. So we get a little bit of a setup where Scott and Jamal give Kinsey a present. It turns out later to be a life preserver.
Hilarious.
Very hilarious. She's wearing it at home as she's IMing with him. And I just want to mention what their IM names are. Kinsey's is Hole in the Head K. Very funny. And I believe Scott's is JSAT. And then Jamal's, Oh, no. Jamal's is JSAT. He's Jamal Saturday.
Yeah, Jamal Saturday.
And Scott's is Devil Worshipper 13, yeah. Which is
oof,
right on for him, of course.
This kid is edgy.
Yeah. And then the kids are at home. Nita calls. She's getting drunk at a bar. And this is when Dodge is sneaking through the house. He discovers the Crown of Shadows. We get a tease of a door that we saw in the last issue as Bodhi was trying to figure out what was last volume, as Bodhi was trying to figure out what was going on with the head key. Rendell hid the Crown of Shadows key in black currant jelly. Dodge makes fun of him and ultimately unveils this chamber below the house that is hiding the Crown of Shadows. And we get a phenomenal page. Phenomenal, where Dodge is standing in front of the Crown of Shadows with a, we see three shadows, three different perspectives of his shadow as light shines up from him. We cut to the Crown of Shadows. He puts the key in it. And then when we cut back to Dodge, there are three wolf heads behind him. Absolutely terrifying. The rest of this issue as well. Very scary. Like I know we've talked about that a bit, but the way they play out the shadows and way they flash back and forth is legitimately scary in a way that we haven't seen really since that first or second issue, I guess, where Dodge popped out of the well.
Yeah, it's so intense because like before we saw it and everything was fun and there were IMing and oh, I got my life jacket on and but man, it takes a turn.
Yeah. So Dodge puts on a veil of shadows because, of course, he doesn't want anybody to know that he is Zach Wells or anything like that. And he tries out three identities. I think the first one is Puck from Midsummer Night's Dream. Is that right?
Maybe. My guess was Peter Pan because a couple pages earlier, Tyler's reading Peter Pan to Bodhi.
It looks to me like Jughead from the old Archie comics.
Ooh, that'd be a fun take.
It might be. Does he have a shadow burger at any point?
I love that.
Then he tries out a ninja, and ultimately he puts on this queen costume based on the Lady in the Well. We do get to see a shadow of Peter Pan attack Bodhi. A shadow of fear attacks Kinsey, of course. And Tyler is just wandering in, eating some pizza, and there's terrifying bears and killer clowns and a night
dude.
Yeah,
the clown is the creepiest with the X'd out eyes. I mean, that's just... And I'd rather fight a bear.
He gets swallowed by the shadows, but he fights back. And that's where we get the first hint of this amazing conflict that's come. The fourth issue is the kids fighting back against the shadows. Kinsey figures out that she can flash shine a flashlight and get them to go away. While Dodge in her shadow form is trying to find out where the Echo key and the Omega key is. But Tyler is spitting in her face, does not care. And one
thing I'd like to point out though, unfortunately it looks like a mistake. Kinsey was wearing the vest in the last attack. And then when you cut back to her fighting fear, the vest is off.
Wow. What a takedown.
You're really good.
Maybe she had time
to
take it out.
No, what are you talking about? It's off. It's off at the end of the last issue. It's sitting on her pillow.
Oh, you're right.
Yeah.
Because she went from typing with it on to then it was off.
Pete, you need to send them an O prize is what needs to happen. Send them an empty envelope. What I love about this issue is that they, without ever referencing it, set up the same situation that happened with Sam Lesser, which is that Kinsey was downstairs under a table protecting Bodhi from Sam Lesser. She was frozen with fear. She couldn't fight back. And Tyler, meanwhile, was taking on Sam Lesser one-on-one. And that's what we get here again, but this time Kinsey is able to flip things around. Bodhi also isn't as scared. He figures out the light thing by shedding the refrigerator light on them, but they fight back with the light and they're not afraid anymore. And I love that. I love that subtle character progression that if you know it, you see it. But if you don't, it's just kind of there and happening in the background.
Yeah. They're so resourceful now. They're able to just like make moves. Because of being at Key House. And I love the way that they discover that Kinsey discovers that light beats shadow. is such a beautiful art device for the rest of this issue, mm-hmm. where we get to see the panel with the horrifying shadows and then the burst of light. And that repeats, and it's just so nice to see.
Yeah. And ultimately, the police detective almost comes up. Classic horror setup. He is right at the door. He is about
classic
to come
die
in.
Die Hard.
Die Hard? That's your reference?
Yeah, because, you know, the police drives up and is about to, you know, drives away and, you know, you got to throw a body at him to get his attention.
Oh, right. And in this case, they throw a pot, but it doesn't actually work because he's listening to the radio. Yep. But the shadows take the memory out of his head. He doesn't remember why he was going there or anything like that. They're all an extension of Dodge. And ultimately, Dodge is like, you know what? Kinsey clearly knows where the key is. I'm going to join all the shadows together, and I'm going to go after Kinsey and Bodie, which frees Tyler, which is Dodge's big mistake here. And I think, to your point you were making earlier, Justin, this is the point where it turns around. This is the point where they figure out how to fight back. And it's because, ultimately, I would say Dodge is improvising too much.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Dodge loses a key at the top of this arc. Like, they're just, these mistakes are starting to compound despite all the success that he's having. So it's really nice to see the villain both succeeding and failing, as opposed to a much more predictable, like, succeeding all the time and then suddenly failing.
Yeah. There's also a lovely pair of panels that happen towards the end of this issue as Bodie and Kinsey are fleeing once Dodge has pulled all the shadows together, where they're running down the stairs past a bench, which we do get to see later on as well. I think Tyler and Kinsey are sitting on it and chatting about Bodie. They run past it and we see the same framing of the panel, but Bodie and Kinsey are almost out of frame. They're running forward. They're getting away. And in the background, in the upper right corner, we see this horrifying wolf's head shadow sticking out that's enormous and gigantic, and we get a tease of what's to come. So fantastic. And at the same time as they're hiding, we get this action montage of Tyler pulling out the giant key, putting it in. We see a glow of light, the opposite of shadow, of course, break through key house. A hand reaches through. And as he teased, we didn't mention this, but Tyler, again, a very nice, subtle setup, but he said something about, like, I'm bigger than you and I'm going to kick your ass Dodge earlier on in the issue. And he comes out and we get a full page splash of him enormous saying, hey, Dogface, can't say I didn't warn you. And that's where he ends the issue. Phenomenal.
Badass.
Such a great line, badass thing to say. But also, I really want to, like, the fact that you see the, you know, the key house, and then there's just this light that shines down the side of it, and then you just get a little hand, or, well, you think it's huge, but it's like, and then you get to see him enormous. Like, such great panel design to, like, save the reveal for when it's, like, the real kind of, like, fight time. Was such a cool thing, because, like, if you would have, like, saw it opening in, like, half of them, it wouldn't have been as powerful or whatever, but, like, the way that they did that and the pacing, like Justin was talking about, it's really just unbelievable.
Now, then we get to issue 5, which, Justin, correct me I'm wrong, but I believe you said is one of your favorite issues of the book, right?
Yeah, I think maybe Pete as well. Like, this issue is just the nonstop, the epic splash page action of it. And just the fact that they just drop out of, they don't need anything else to tell the story besides these huge splash pages. And it's not all just the action. We get to see these reaction shots from Kinsey and Bodie and all these, like, very comic booky moments, while at the same time never losing a step with this sort of dark fantasy story they're telling, is just...
It's great, because it's like, if I, you know, like a younger me was in charge of a comic book, I feel like, why do we have to wait so long for a fight, or why do we have to wait so long for a splash page? Make it all splash pages. And this is just, like, such an amazing build up and payoff.
Yeah, it's absolutely fantastic. I don't think it's exactly inspired by the Death of Superman issue, which is another very famous full page splash issue, but it plays out so well. And to accomplish something like this, where you can keep track of the action in single panels, essentially, that have so many things going on with him throughout, and that it also feels like a full story. Like, you don't feel like, ah, oh man, I read through a 22 panels and that's it, and I'm done. I mean, I think it's a little more than that. And ultimately, once they win, it does break down into more panels, but you still feel like you're getting a full meal from the comic book, which is so nice. Now, one other thing that I want to mention, which doesn't show up at least in the volume that I have in the back matter, they have a cover gallery. This also had one of my favorite covers, and I think it was a variant that they put out where they put it. They did it like a giant-sized comic issue, and it says, giant-sized action, smashing issue. And they did it sort of like old-school style with the logo and the quarter and the price and everything. Yeah. Absolutely love that, and just so much fun. And that, to what we were saying earlier, Justin, about this being a turning point, after they beat Dodge, after Dodge loses the Crown of Shadows and the Head Key, and they manage to save Key House, and Dodge is barely there, lying on the beach, what Tyler does is he picks them up, lifts them up, shows them all of Lovecraft, and said, "This is home, guys. We're not going to run from shadows here. Not tonight. Not ever."
Yeah! And it's,
well, yeah, but it's also, it's such a beautiful statement.
Yeah, and it's also like, it always surprises me, that moment, because Tyler is not concerned with like finishing the victory there and like getting the Crown of Shadows, all that. He's like, "Oh, let me show how good we are right now," to his brother and sister, which is just so nice.
Yeah. And the other thing, just in terms of the structure of the issues that I do want to mention, because I was kind of looking for this, is they do such a good job of keeping Dodge in the form of Zach Wells out of everybody's sight, that just in the geography of the scene, he could very easily be discovered. But say Tyler is looking in the other direction while Zach is protected by a wave so he can't see him. Later on, again, he's hidden by a rock. And there's one other thing that happens that is such a perfect Godzilla monster movie thing that I feel like they just put in for fun. Is
the kid in the teddy bear?
The kid with the teddy bear. As they're fighting by it, there's just a little girl with a teddy bear that looks up and sees the enormous Tyler. And it's just delightful. Like, it doesn't tie into the plot in any way. It's just a fun thing to put in there for the
issue. It's a good image.
That poor little kid's going to need therapy later.
Really? You think so?
I don't know, man. She just witnessed a giant shadow monster fighting a giant human.
Yeah, I guess. I guess they probably should have taken the memory out of her head as well.
Yeah.
Not just Bodhi. Yeah, just a thought. Then we get this last issue. This is the epilogue. This is the hangover from everything that happened as
so
Nina
real quick,
gets
I just
back.
Want to say, the scene with Jordan and Tyler at the end of that fifth issue. We get this moment
I'm sorry. I skipped by the end of that. I apologize.
That's right. And it's just a quick moment, but I think it's really important. So Jordan comes up to him. Tyler was so confident that he like won her over by giving her the paper that he wrote, but because he cheated and put the book in his head using the head key. She got an F on the paper because it didn't show any thinking. It was just like a list of facts, basically. And I think this teaches Tyler that these keys are fallible. Like they're not in like a way that you use them and you win, which is what Dodge thinks. And so I think Tyler learns in this moment that these keys give you a great power, but they also give you a weakness. And I think that is huge for the way that the story unfolds throughout the rest of the issues of the series.
So Pete, please go ahead.
Oh, well, if you wanted to talk about that point, since we're going backwards, something we missed I wanted to talk about as well.
I was just going to say, and this is very important, and thank you for pausing and allowing me to bring this up, that would you say that with that great power comes something else, like anything else in particular?
No, I don't. Honestly, I don't. I've never heard anyone say that half of that sentence, so I don't have an answer to that.
Okay, like with great speechless. Power comes more keys!
I feel irresponsible, but I'm speechless.
One thing I wanted to talk about, when the mom comes home and the house is trashed and stuff, there's a moment with Bodhi that I didn't notice before, and it's that same kind of like four panel grid, but in the last panel the shadow turns into that evil Peter Pan shadow, and I never noticed that before.
Yeah. I mean, that's because the magic is not gone. Things are still going badly. Also, what do you think about the decision for them to take this memory out of Bodhi's head? Because I feel like it's incorrect. Like, they do the wrong thing there.
Yeah, it is a little weird. I agree.
Yeah.
Yeah. Leave memories in people's heads. That's all I'm saying. The thing that I actually wanted to ask you guys about are the last three panels here, where after Tyler has messed up with Jordan, he sees the leaves start falling and he says, huh, pretty yeah. nice around here where the leaves start to change color. And we get a shot of a tree letting a leaf loose. The next panel, the leaf is floating across the side of the panel. And the last panel is just a simple blue and white sky, and that's it. What do you think that means?
I think Gabriel Rodriguez is like, wait, we could end it here. You know, we don't have to keep doing like all of this art is killing me. This is mm-hmm. so much detail. I can't keep going on like this.
I just drew 15 fucking splash pages. Give me a break for these last three panels, yeah. man.
It's funny because it's to me, it's just like a nice little moment after all this like total chaos. And he's just like stopping and enjoying the beauty of nature. And then it's just like the camera kind of like pans up a little bit and we kind of get to enjoy it, too.
I think it's sort of a reflection of what he said to Kinsey and Bodhi. Where he, when we first met Tyler, he was like super mm-hmm. depressed in a very dark place. And then he just had this epic fight and won. And he's like, you know what? I do feel comfortable here, despite all this insanity. And the fact that I just blew it with this girl that I like. I think things are coming my way.
I mean, it might also be as simple as it's to what you're saying, Justin, it's ending with light instead of shadows. Yeah. Like there's still a little bit of darkness encroaching in the corner there, in the upper left corner of the panel. But ultimately, we're seeing white shine out there.
And he's in shadow, right? He's in the shadow of the statue.
The statue, yeah. So at least for the moment, light has won, but the shadow is always going to be there. Maybe that's one way of looking at it.
Yeah.
Then we get to the last issue, the epilogue, Beyond Repair, a huge emotional gut punch throughout this issue.
Oof. Yeah.
Oh, God. This is in exactly the right way, but so hard to read. For yeah. multiple reasons. And one of the biggest reasons, I think, is how Gabriel Rodriguez draws Nina Locke throughout this issue. She is just haggard. She is tired. She is worn out. She is done with everything. And she is completely losing control, not just of her children, but of her body and her mind at this point. And it's there is barely a panel where she does not have a drink in her hand. She is helping Bodhi. We start with a horrifying series of panels where we just see Bodhi grabbing his chin and leaving a bloody handprint on the wall. We don't even know why. While Nina watches a video of Rendell juggling plates, and he comes in, and it turns out it's nothing to do with Dodge or anything like that. He's just banged his chin, and he's bleeding from his chin. And she ultimately, that is how they discover he was trying to find a key. They ultimately discover this key that can fix things. It opens a cabinet. You put things in the cabinet and it repairs things. It's the
mending key.
The mending key. And she ends up breaking a bunch of plates. We see things breaking and cracking throughout this issue. And Nina discovers her cane. She was hurt during the attack by Sam Lesser, has been repaired by this cabinet. Now, I think the way she's able to keep track of this magic is probably because she's drunk, right?
Yeah, I think so. I think the idea that you have to be a kid to see the magic of Key House, and when you're drunk, you sort of have a smaller brain,
if you will.
Like you're infantilized a little bit. So I think she's just like, oh, okay. This works.
Yeah. And we also get to see the cabinet. It stretches to fill whatever you're putting in it. So she tries the cane. She tries a stool that was broken. She tries plates and repairs those. And then she tries juggling everything. It all breaks, but she doesn't care. This to me is an interesting sequence of pages, because we see this really beautiful freed expression on her face as she juggles these plates, juggles a wine bottle, juggles a wine glass. And the next panel, everything is breaking around her. She says, "Go ahead and smash, you fuckers. I can fix you later. I can fix everything." What do you think Nina is feeling at this point? Because to me, it reads as manic.
I love the moment. It's like a little moment of magic that yeah. she is juggling the plates. Like, she actually gets to fully be free in this. Like, it feels like she is just like being crushed by all these things that have happened to her in her life. And this is the first time we've seen her be actually free. And I don't know. I wouldn't call it manic. I think it's like in her drunken state, dealing, like finding this magic. She's like, "Oh, I have a tool that will solve my problems." And that's where mm-hmm. I think she gets into this next reveal, where she puts the urn with Rendell's ashes.
Oh, yeah. This is heartbreaking here.
Yeah. This is a gut punch of a panel right here, because we see her in the bathroom. She goes, "So what do we fix next? What really needs, huh?" as she's opening a bottle of wine. And then we get a panel of her tying into the shadows of the overall arc, but she's completely half in shadow, barely holding herself up, and in the foreground is the urn that holds Rendell Locke's ashes. And what did you think, if you could think back this far, what did you think the first time you read this? Did you think he was going to come back? He was not going to come back? What was your impression?
I was hoping it would, but the look on her face when she puts that urn in the cabinet is just unbelievable. It says so much.
I feel like they do a good job of showing the video of him almost as if it's a setup that we're about to see him. Mm-hmm. I thought we might get some sort of magical version of him. But, I mean, he's like the Uncle Ben of this series. He's the one character you can't bring back.
Yeah, and as we know, wait, what was that lesson that Uncle Ben taught Spider-Man?
Stop, I always forget what it is. Come on.
I think he said, always have a spare pair of underwear.
Mm, okay.
Smart.
Yeah. So it definitely, like, if this was going to bring it back, it would be monkey paw.
Oh,
rules,
I remember
right?
what it was. It was, "With great shower comes great rinseability."
Love that guy. Love that. I hope they bring him back. I hope Marvel brings him back sometime soon, because that would be fun.
You shut your face.
So, yes, all of the facial acting that they do, that Gabriel Rodriguez does here, is absolutely heartbreaking and awful. She thinks maybe the urn is going to take longer, and then we get an excruciatingly rock bottom point for Nina, where she's dressing in sexy lingerie. She thinks she sees him back, goes up, rubs the back of his head, but it turns out to be Tyler, which is horrifying.
Oh, horrifying.
Horrifying. Tough. He shoves her. They fight. The urn breaks on the floor. And then she slaps Kinsey. And all of this keeps happening. And it just gets worse and worse. Like, this is... You feel for Nina the entire time, but it's so clear this is the absolute lowest she can go.
Yeah, it is truly this issue is such a dark, sad way to end this arc. It's mm-hmm. crazy to me that they did it this way, but it's great.
Well, yeah, but also gives you a little hope right at the end, though.
I don't know. Yeah. The end reveal we're about to talk about is, to me, it's more stressful. I'm like, oh, you have to hide this key. To say what it is, they find the Omega key in their father's ashes.
Oh. Yeah.
And I agree. That is absolutely hard. Oh, go ahead, Pete.
I'm sorry. I feel like that's what the cabinet fixed. Like, that key wasn't there, but the cabinet put that key there to fix what's going on with them.
Oh, that's interesting.
Interesting. I take it, my takeaway from reading that at the end of that, them finding the Omega key is like, oh my God, this is the thing that Dodge has wanted this entire time. The one thing keeping them safe at this point is they have no idea what it is or where to find it or anything. And now they know. And now they need to keep that key safe. They need to keep that information away. They are utterly screwed.
Yeah, that's what I thought too. It's such a tense, and I love the way that they've established what the Omega Key looks like without talking about it. So it's just a visual reveal in this moment. So great. And one thing I want to say that we haven't talked about before is the recap page of this series, each issue is so good. I love it. And it reminds me of Battlestar Galactica's recap before they went into every episode. It's just like so concise, so smart. Really?
Oh, how are you reading this? Because I'm reading it in the collective volumes. That's how I'm going back. Are you reading the individual issues?
I am, yes.
Oh, okay. I forgot about this. How do they do it?
It's like one page, and it's almost like it's very poetically told. It's all in black and white. And it's like it explains Key House. And it's like they need to – I don't have it in front of me, but they need to collect the keys to survive. And like it's – you see a bunch of keys that you don't know what they mean yet. Like it's a picture of Dodge. Like it is just really well done.
Can we talk about just to take a step backwards? There is one detail that we probably should talk about before we kind of wrap up this volume, which is the revelation that they've been hinting at throughout the volume that something else happened to Nina. And as it turns out, she, while Sam was killing Rendell Locke, she was actually raped by Al, the guy that was working with Sam, who ultimately, I think she was the one who chopped him in the head with the axe and killed him, right?
Yep.
This is awful. This adds an extra layer to everything. I don't know how to feel about this. I feel like this went by me the first time I read it, and it wasn't until reading it this time that I really picked up on it. And it's a rough revelation. What's your take on it?
Yeah, I mean, agree. Like, especially like just someone who's been crushed so hard to then throw this additional horrifying detail on there is horrible.
Also, it helps explain why she's maybe hitting the sauce so hard.
Well, I think, I mean, she'd be well justified to do it if it was just Rendell being killed. But I think what it does, for better or for worse, and certainly we could get into issues with adding sexual assault characteristics onto a female character in comics, though I would argue that I think they do it responsibly here because they're treating all the characters evenly, is every single one of them has their own private pain and their own thing that they are dealing with, both with the attack that Sam and Al did on the house, but also just ongoing what's happening on Key House. So ultimately, in order to beat Dodge, they're all going to have to work together and come back together as a family. They were split apart by what happened. But like we've discussed, Tyler has his own thing. Kinsey has her own thing. Bodhi probably has something that we haven't really dealt with it yet. And Nina certainly has their own thing. And I think that's what that clarifies there, because we've been very focused on the kids, but now we understand how Nina is part of this as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, that all out of the way. Before we wrap up here, let's unlock our key moments for this volume. What is the key moment for you? I can start on this one. I would say we've talked about it already, but that scene on the staircase, that one pager, I think about that all the time, with Dodge hiding below, mostly in shadow, with Nina and Tyler up above. It is a absolutely wonderful one page spread that I think is so well done. And the second page that I think of after the one of Dodge emerging from the well when I think about the series.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
Justin, what about you? Got a key moment?
My key moment is just Tyler emerging as a hero. Both, I guess it's sort of two moments. Both he takes the power of the giant key and wins. They finally carve out a real win for the Locke family when they haven't really had that yet. And then I just mentioned it, the second revelation that these keys are powerful, but there is they aren't all powerful. And I think that is what eventually saves him in the end.
Yeah. Pete, what about you? Key moment.
Key moment is, for me, it's the giant spread panel where Tyler has the, you know, evil monster on his back. And as he's kind of fighting, he looks out of the corner of his eye and sees the lighthouse, like, and just this moment of, like, even when the things look bad, like, he's still seeing the light, and he's still, there is still hope. And I feel like that giant page, like, really kind of sums up, like, he's, there's so much they're dealing with, so much that's on their back, and there's so much, but they're still like, they're still smart enough to kind of see the light and fight for it.
All right. If you would like to support our show, patreon.com/comicbookclub. Also, we do a live show every Tuesday night at 7 p.m. at the People's Improv Theater Loft in New York. Come on by. We would love to chat with you about Lock and Key. A couple of places socially you can check us out. Lock and Key Pod on Twitter, on Instagram, and on Facebook. Also, iTunes, Android, Spotify, and Stitcher, or the app of your choice to subscribe or listen to the podcast. Please do comment also on iTunes. That really helps us out a whole lot. ComicBookClubLive.com for this podcast and more. And remember, with great power comes great shots, 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 right?
It is 9 o'clock, according to Pete's visor.